Hi, my name is Katarzyna Terlecka. I am a founder of Heal Yourself platform that shares knowledge and recommends resources, people and events that enable you to look at your health and well-being from a holistic perspective. I am so excited to share with you my 8th podcast and first one in English. My guest Peter Woodcraft is a certified therapist and teacher of Shiatsu, a Japanese body therapy with roots in ancient tradition of Oriental medicine. In the podcast, Peter explains in detail how exactly Shiatsu works and why it is so good for your health. What made me especially interested in this method is that it affects not only your body, but also your mind and emotions. Also, through stimulation of energy, Shiatsu can prevent as well as deal with a number of medical issues. Isn't it fascinating? Okay, let's hear what Peter has to say about it. Enjoy. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you for inviting me today.
Thank you for finding the time to see me and to talk about Shiatsu. I must say I'm very excited because I've done so far 8 episodes and this is the first one which I will do in English. So it is the special one for me.
Excellent.
And also I'm very excited that we will have opportunity to spread the word about Shiatsu.
Me too.
Because I experienced it twice.
Okay, great.
It did amazing job for my body and my mind, and I think people really need to know about it more and really experience it more because it's fantastic.
Yeah, of course, I couldn't agree more.
Okay, so before we talk about Shiatsu, I would like to briefly refer to the whole purpose of my platform and ask you, what is your way for healing yourself?
Yeah, it's a big, big question, and I want to answer it with some kind of quite specific ideas, if I may.
Of course.
I want to start by talking about how we're encouraged to think of ourselves more holistically, more and more in recent times. So, again, as you said, think about the body, think about the emotions, think about the spirit, if you like, or those qualities, the soul,
yeah.
Yes, and the mind. And we have this holistic approach and more, but what I feel is a little bit missing still in this puzzle, if you like, is that we don't tend to look at medicine as a whole in a holistic way. And that's the thing that I'm finding for myself is very useful. So of course I favor natural modalities to treat myself, but I remain completely open to the possibility of engaging and using traditional Western medicinal practices and, you know, pharmaceuticals as well, where necessary and where I feel that's going to be the best way for me to operate and be as healthy as I can be in any given situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think very often now we live in such a time pressured world. If we had more time, for sure we could rely entirely, I think, on natural medicine. But the reality is many times we're in situations where there just isn't the time and space to stop and let our bodies recover the way we would like to. And then, you know, then I think it's okay to look for support in other ways, be that pharmaceutical or whatever, as a short term, kind of a stopgap,
mm-hmm.
knowing that, okay, I get through this and then I'm at the weekend and I can come back and just,
yeah.
you know, and let my body rest properly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's finding this balance,
mm-hmm.
and moving into this kind of newish world of integrative medicine, where we're not just looking at one modality as being the correct modality,
mm-hmm.
or the only one we can use,
mm-hmm.
but we're looking at possibility of multiple modalities,
mm-hmm.
and picking what works for us in any given situation of both good health and poor health,
mm-hmm.
because I think that's the other thing, we forget about prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a key factor for me, is doing things on a regular basis as prevention to maintain good emotions, to maintain good physical shape and good mental health. And that is me equally important as going to my doctor for a regular checkup or getting a blood test. So, you know, for me, going for a walk in the woods has equal value as getting a blood test
for my
health and how I move forward. And it's about having being choice, mm-hmm. and to be able to make positive choices for ourselves, we need quality information and we need education. And that's a huge inspiration for me with my work on a one-to-one level with clients, but also because I teach shiatsu, so, you know, educating more and more people to give them the tools with which they can help themselves more easily and make better choices for their health.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the term integrative medicine. Mm-hmm. Do I understand correctly? It combines the Eastern and Western medicine.
Yes.
That's the term, integrative.
Yes. There's huge progress made actually in China, mm-hmm. particularly, where if you study to be a doctor, generally speaking, at the beginning anyway, you study both classical Oriental medicine and Western medicine. So you have to do both if you want to be a doctor in China, and then you might specialize. Then it might be okay, yeah, I like that part, I want to specialize, I want to be a gastrologist or something. Mm-hmm. But you've still got that awareness of the other possibilities. So you get these stories coming out of China where someone goes with a stomach problem and they first of all go to the most, you know, the most ready option, which is to the traditional doctor. And the traditional doctor takes the pulse, looks at the tongue, everything else. Says, I think it's this, but you know what? I just want to check. So I'm going to refer you for a gastroscopy just so we can actually get a picture of really what's inside your stomach, just to be sure.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Which is amazing for me. Yeah. And then the decision is, so do we need to do some surgery? No, we don't. Okay, so we'll go back to the traditional methods. We'll use some herbal formulas because that's the most effective and, in fact, the cheapest way of treatment. Mm-hmm. So that's what we'll do. Mm-hmm. And so we can find a pathway that fits that individual. And this is another key thing about which we'll come on to much more later, treating individuals.
Yeah. So not all listeners are familiar with shiatsu. So maybe we will start from this. What is it and where it comes from?
Yes. Because the first thing is the joke, it's not a little dog, it's not a shih tzu, it's shiatsu.
I haven't heard
You've not heard that one? It's very common thing.
I know which dog you mean.
Little toy dogs. So it's not that, it's shiatsu. It's from Japan. Mm-hmm. It's the term itself, shiatsu, is relatively modern. It was coined at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. So it's not like the word is from ancient tradition. But its roots very much so from the ancient traditions of classical Oriental medicine. What does it look like in practice? It's done, for one thing, very important thing I think your listeners will be interested in, it's done fully clothed. So you don't have to take your clothes off, there's no oils. And I think for a lot of people are still perhaps, you know, we're encouraged not to be, but I think many people are body conscious and perhaps not 100% comfortable with taking their clothes off to receive a massage. And so in shiatsu, that's not necessary. You remain fully clothed, so already you probably feel a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more relaxed. There's not this sense of possible shame or embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And also you stay warmer, because most people tend to get a bit chilly when they receive a massage.
Yeah, especially at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you're clothed, you don't experience that. Traditionally, it's done on the floor, on a Japanese mattress, a futon. And that's much the best place to receive shiatsu. It can be done on a massage table, but I would recommend not going that way. It's much nicer, both for giver and receiver.
Would you prefer not to do it on the massage
I think table? You just feel that much safer on the floor. You know, someone's pushing you around, maybe rotating your shoulders and your hips or something. On the floor, there's never this sensation of, wait a minute, I'm going to fall. Mm-hmm. There's nowhere to fall. So you're like 100% safe. Mm-hmm. It's also easier for the practitioner, because it's easier on your back, it's easier on everything physically to give shiatsu on the floor.
Okay.
Yeah. What actually happens in the treatment is I lean on the person's body using my body weight. So you can see, I mean, your listeners can't, but you can see I'm not a big, strong person. Like sometimes you picture a massage therapist with bulging biceps, it's not me. And you don't need to be a hugely strong person to give shiatsu, because you're just using your body weight and that's all you need to do. And then, so with this relaxed body weight, I lean on the person's body, and that has two effects. So the first effect we think about in terms of classical Oriental medicine. that by leaning on that person's body, I influence the flow of their qi, or in Japanese, or qi in Chinese, or energy, most common translation in English. And the flow of qi is absolutely important for health. So qi warms the body, it helps the body move, it helps the body transform things like food into nutrients that we can use in the body. And for it to do that, it needs to be moving and flowing. And very often the simplest way to explain ill health in terms of Oriental medicine is to say the qi has not flowing properly. We call it qi stagnation, mm-hmm. this technical term, which means it's not flowing properly. So then certain functions aren't happening the way they should. So then if we can make it flow better, the person will feel better on every level. So physically they may feel less pain, because pain is often a symptom of qi stagnation. Emotionally, they're probably going to feel better too, because just as we feel stuck in our bodies and that creates pain in a joint or a muscle, we also get stuck in our emotions sometimes and we experience emotional pain. So when the qi flows, that also tends to feel better. And then the third thing there is that it helps us to prevent disease, like I said earlier. Yes, if the qi is flowing and we have shiatsu quite regularly, it just helps prevent any stagnation occurring, any things getting stuck and stopping to function so well. Mm-hmm. So that's the Oriental perspective. Very interestingly, yeah. with shiatsu, we always also have a Western perspective. So the Western perspective is by leaning on the body in this way, we stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system. So this is the part of the nervous system which is active when the body is resting.
Okay.
And it's active because it actually stimulates cellular regeneration within the organs and tissues of the body. So when we stimulate this part of the nervous system, we're basically saying to the body, it's time to stop, it's time to rest, it's time to regenerate. Mm-hmm. So this is very, very cool, I think.
Yeah.
I love this.
Extremely. And you know, this what you said that about the Eastern approach, it's like exactly what I heard when I was studying the ancient Chinese medicine,
yes.
about qi and about, yep. being sick, when you are sick, stagnation. And it's the way you described is really clear. So I hope people will really
so.
Get it, because sometimes when I talk to my friends, because they try to pass on this, mm-hmm. what I learned, it's always this issue now, but why you are talking about stagnation all the time? Because, mm-hmm. I talk mostly in terms of food about stagnation,
okay.
yes?
Mm-hmm.
And this of course has also impact on the energy flow, mm. but I think the way you describe it now, it's like perfect, so
okay.
Thank you,
I'm glad to hear that, thank you for the feedback. The other important thing about the PNS and everything else is also that this encourages the body to be in a situation where it can rest.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I come back to my earlier point, we live in such a constantly on world these days, and it seems to be increasingly difficult for people. I mean, they may go to bed at night, but it's not necessarily they sleep very well, because their body just isn't actually in a place where it can sleep well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is hugely important in modern society more than ever, is to find ways that people find their own ways, but to find ways that they can to get better rest, to get better sleep. I mean, the number of patients I have with insomnia problems, and you know, the feedback is great. They really find, particularly the night after their treatment, mm. they come in, wow, I slept so well that night. It really,
yeah.
helped me. And over time, that developed into a better habit of sleeping patterns,
mm-hmm.
as well. And that's,
yeah.
really powerful.
Yeah. So what you are saying is mainly that it can help, first of all, to prevent,
mm-hmm.
the sickness,
yeah.
but as well, once you are already sick, shiatsu can help as well.
Yes.
So maybe you could elaborate on,
yeah.
this a little bit more.
Particularly for chronic disease, in my,
mm-hmm.
experience, so things that are not particularly well treated by traditional Western medicine. I mean, you know, acute things where you need surgery, of course, you know, Western medicine is miraculous, the things,
yeah.
they can do these days. It's incredible, it's brilliant, technology and everything, wonderful, and very skilled and dedicated people. But sometimes we get kinds of disease which are not so easy to understand and have a range of different symptoms that come and go. So, you know, the person's coming backwards and forwards to the doctor, and the doctor's like, oh, we'll try this, we'll try that, and nothing really seems to keep working for very long, and that person just lives with this condition. And I think this is where shiatsu has a huge role to play for many people. And I'll give you my own health story as an example here, because I think it's relevant. When I first ever received a shiatsu treatment, I'd already actually enrolled to do a course because I was just like totally in love with the idea anyway. But I thought, well, before I do the course, maybe I should get a treatment, you know, to see what it's all about. And a student practitioner, she hadn't fully qualified, was a friend of a friend, so I went to her. And she decided that she should work on my lung channel. So a little bit, there's channels and meridians in the body, we'll maybe talk about it a bit more later. So she picked my lung channel.
And lung, she worked, like?
Lung as in putz. And she and I, after the treatment, I just felt a big change in the whole of my chest. So it felt much more open, much lighter, and kind of stronger somehow. Now, I had already been diagnosed with asthma, kind of allergic asthma, for the previous 10 to 12 years. And I was pretty dependent on my little squirty inhaler for controlling the symptoms. But this feeling, after just one treatment, this feeling made me think, well, hang on a minute, maybe there's a different way of looking at this. And that was the beginning of my journey, you could say. And of course, it, you know, it wasn't a miracle cure. It wasn't like because of that one treatment, suddenly I didn't have asthma anymore. But it opened up the possibility to how I could work with my body and the symptoms and the things that seemed to create bad situation for me to better control my own asthmatic symptoms. With the result is that now, all these years later, I don't get very often, I hardly ever get any symptoms. I don't use an inhaler. I'm sure it could happen again. You know, I'm open to the possibility there's there's susceptibility maybe in me somewhere that the right circumstances, it could happen, of course, you know. But generally speaking, I manage it by myself, so I'm not dependent on the pharmaceutical product, which is expensive. So that's better for our health services, which are struggling all the time with money. And turns out it's even better for the environment, because the propellant they use in these gases is a greenhouse gas, so we're all, you know, contributing to climate change by taking our inhalers, which is a sad thought.
But so you are saying that because of shiatsu, you stop having symptoms, or you have them much
much more rarely, and at this point, I've stopped. I mean, I don't remember the last time I had what I could call an asthmatic attack. I really cannot remember that. I mean, I can remember what that feels like very clearly, and it's horrible. But I don't remember the last time I actually had an attack where I felt I need something to help me breathe right now, because it's really getting uncomfortable.
And I can imagine there will be there would be a question from some people. So how many times do you need to do shiatsu? Of course, you know, I can imagine it's a period of years.
Potentially, and of course, it depends on the individual, and it depends how quickly that individual can adapt certain things that they find in their life that are difficult and that they relate to getting the attack, and either avoid those things, stop them altogether if possible, or find other solutions that can help them manage those situations much more comfortably for themselves. And they may still be taking the inhaler sometimes. I mean, if it's necessary, it's a lifesaver sometimes. So it's not that I'm saying do this and never ever use that stuff again, because if you're an asthmatic, you should probably have that with you just in case asthma kills sometimes, so you have to take it very seriously.
So can shiatsu help in case of emotional pain?
Absolutely.
And how you work differently with emotional pain comparing to physical pain?
In a way, we don't particularly work very differently with emotional pain versus physical pain, because we see the body as a unity, as one thing. We see it holistically. So there may be physical pain, and we see that the emotional pain at the same time is related to that physical pain. So it's not necessarily that we treat it differently, but I think what's important here is that we recognize the importance of putting the person in the center of our diagnosis. So sometimes, particularly from my experience, it's easy with treating mental health issues to label things, to say, oh, this person's like this, this person's bipolar, or this person's got depression. And then they've got this label, And so they receive a certain kind of treatment for that label, mm-hmm. and not really as an individual anymore. And I think that's super important. I had a lot of experience with this back in London before moving to Poland. For about 5 years, I was working in a multidisciplinary team, two psychologists, myself and an acupuncturist, working with the same group of patients. So many times we would share a patient. And then we had weekly case conferences where we would talk about that and get feedback from each other about the relationship, precisely the relationship between the physical things that mostly I was observing, but also the mental things that the psychologists were observing, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I say, oh, you know, that patient said to me such and such and such, and such. Wow, they've never told me that. All this time I've been speaking, they've never said something about that. I said, mm-hmm. okay, well, because it was, we were talking about their back pain, let's say. And then, because we were talking about that, something else came out and yeah. they talked about this other yeah. emotional side. So yeah. it was fascinating. And vice versa, sometimes the psychologist would say, but did you know that person gets headaches all the time? Never said it to me. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, but for me, what you're saying, it's like ideal, you know. I would love that my psychologist talks mm-hmm. to my acupuncture doctor, because yeah. I have acupuncture right. as well, and then have also the shiatsu specialist taking
this
care.
Is,
that would be like
yeah.
ideal way of treating patients.
This is what I mean by integrative medicine, yeah. when we look at the whole picture mm-hmm. of everything we can, but we keep the person in the center of everything mm-hmm. we're doing. So the decisions we make with regard to diagnosis and treatment always come back to, but how does that relate to this individual in this circumstance right now? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important, because we want to help people be as well as they can. We have to recognize that sometimes that isn't necessarily that well compared to the overall population, but for that individual, it might be a huge sense of improvement, even though objectively we say, well, that person's still sick. But for them, they might feel like so different. Mm-hmm. I've heard so many stories from my own practice and from my teachers' practices where people have come regularly for shiatsu, and there doesn't seem to be any improvement. Mm-hmm. As mindful practitioners, we're always thinking, oh, I should be getting better. What's going on? You know, I want them to be better. And then sometimes you stop and you just take a review with the person. You just say, well, come on, you've been coming for 6 months and, I don't see very much progress. I wonder if I'm still the right practitioner. Maybe you should see someone else. And so often the feedback is, oh, no. This is the only place every time in the week, my hour, where I feel normal. It's like, mm. oh my goodness, okay. This is super important for that individual. And then it brings it back. You put this person in the center of what's going on, then you can see the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm. It's really, really powerful.
Mm-hmm. And coming back to this place where you were treating patients together with psychologists, acupuncturists in England, were you treating like special kind of sicknesses? Or
kind of,
it was like for everybody?
Kind of dual diagnosis, which means they had mental health problems mm-hmm. and they often had substance abuse problems.
Okay.
So that's the specific, very specific area. So it's very...
So shiatsu can be also good for substance abuse.
I happen to get involved mm-hmm. with that. I wouldn't want to say it's like, again, a silver bullet or something. It's not. Mm-hmm. But it can prove helpful, yes. Mm-hmm. Particularly in that context of, also looking at cognitive behavioral therapy and other modalities mm-hmm. at the same time as a package. Yes, mm-hmm. then it was really quite powerful.
Okay, so just to sum up, it's like when somebody has like depression, mm-hmm. it's good to try shiatsu.
Yes, they should look for someone who has full qualification mm-hmm. because it's always a more difficult area, the emotional area. Back pain is back pain. All right, fine, we know what we're doing, kind mm-hmm. of. So then I would say, you don't need a terribly huge amount of experience to be, you need good qualification, but mm-hmm. But I think someone for mental health problems, depression, then you need to look for someone with experience and to be very open and say, this is why I'm coming. Mm-hmm. Do you think you might be able to help me? Mm-hmm. I would be very happy to hear if you think it's too much for you. You know, I don't think patients should get involved with therapists where the therapist is stepping outside of their comfort zone, because then it's the developing because trust is really important in this, in these cases, and if there's no trust, then it's probably not going to be optimal, let's say.
Yeah, the question is whether the therapist will be honest enough to say, no, it's beyond my possibilities.
Well, that's the thing, because shiatsu is the body work. We're dealing with the body primarily. It can be as a result of dealing with the body that some emotional issues are also resolved. And again, I think working in conjunction with someone going to a talking therapy at the same time, then I think it's even more powerful.
But has it ever happened that somebody came for physical issue, treatment of a physical issue, and something emotional came out in during or after?
I mean, in a sense, almost always. But if that person's not got a mental health diagnosis or it's not particularly an issue for them, that it's not necessarily even a big revelation, just suddenly they realize, do you know what? I don't remember the last time I shouted at my partner. Why is that? Oh, you know, something like that.
I hope they kind of notice.
But it's gradual.
Yeah.
It's like it's very subtle. The changes are at a deep level, very subtle level. And it's not you suddenly click and everything's different. It might be sometimes, again, everybody's individual, but generally it's this slowly things seem to soften and gentle and be different, and you realize looking back after a few months, wow, I do feel quite different now. And we have a lot of theoretical stuff that helps us treat emotional conditions. So both in terms, well, primarily in terms of classical oriental medicine, we're looking at the theory of the five elements, which has this idea of five if almost personality types, and this really helps us to understand can help us to understand someone's emotions and the relationships between those emotions, which is perhaps one of the most interesting features of all of this.
So maybe now we will go this five elements theory, and maybe you can briefly tell us a little bit about it and how it helps you also to make a diagnosis.
So the five elements is part of classical oriental medicine. Many people may have heard of it. It's become very big recently. People go on cookery courses according to the five elements. People study feng shui to study internal architecture according to the five elements. So it pervades all of oriental thought and culture, and has done for probably millennia. So, you know, we're talking about a very, in a way, very advanced system of thought. Let's get back to, you know, simply what it is, what are the five elements, first question, I guess. So the first thing is, what are the five? They are wood, fire, earth, metal, and water. Those are the five elements. And each one has a sort of set of very specific correspondences, which we can observe in nature, so kind of in a macrocosmic way, and we can observe in people, so in a more microcosmic way. So I think the best thing is always is to take one of the elements as an example, because if we talk about all five, we'll be here for the rest of the afternoon. So maybe another time. But looking at the wood element, let's start with the wood element. In nature, if we observe how trees grow, how plants grow, what time of year they grow, what happens when they grow, we can make various conclusions. We notice that generally things grow in the springtime. You know, little green shoots pop out of the hardened, frost-hardened ground, and they have this strength to still burst through, little green shoots. And then they want to grow upwards and outwards, away from gravity and towards the light. They're pre-programmed to do this. This is what plants do. Doesn't matter if you turn them the other way around, they still bend to go against gravity or towards the light, whichever. So we can take that and say that's a general energetic quality of this element, which we can observe in plants. Let's look at people. What can we observe about people that might be similar in some way? So we can say, let's think of something where there's lots of symptoms in the upper body, where things seem to be coming up and outwards into the from the center of the body towards the top of the body.
Like,
so a nice
stomach issues stomach issues?
For example, reflux, things like that could be, it absolutely is a very good example physically. But also the emotions, which emotion is like that? Anger is really like that, okay? When you get angry, your face goes red, your voice gets loud, your eyes go big, you know, everything's very, lots of mad hand gestures perhaps, it's all coming upwards and outwards. So we can say, all right, so then it makes sense to say that the emotion of anger relates to the wood element, because the signs, the things that happen in that moment seem to relate very closely to what happens in springtime in nature. So we make this conclusion, this correspondence, and we build up the whole picture based on the same idea of observation. So the color associated with wood elements, it's green because plants are green. The time of year is spring. The time of day is the morning. And so on and so forth. The direction is the east where the sun rises. And we build up this whole big table of correspondences. Then we have to make a little bit of a leap of faith and just accept the theory for what it is, because there's also correspondences to each of the element to the internal organs, and from the internal organs to the channels and meridians that cover the body where the ki is flowing. So in the case of the wood
meridians,
element,
for people who don't know this term, maybe you can
I use both. I mean, I actually prefer channels very strongly because it's the idea of a three-dimensional passage or something that contains something physical, whereas meridian is more of a intellectual conceptual idea, like the lines on the globe. They're not actually lines on the globe, it's just an idea we've come up with to help us understand time and this sort of thing. So I actually prefer channels, but I use the word meridians too because some people are more familiar with that expression. They're interchangeable. Personally, I prefer channels because I do think they actually physically exist, not because we observe them to exist, but because they actually exist.
And you were saying about, because I interrupted you, about the connection to the organs, yes?
Yes. So in the wood element, the two organs that are connected to the wood elements, the liver and the gallbladder, and so those are also the channels. So it means that when we observe someone who has a lot of anger issues in their life, you know, we talk to them and we say, they say, yeah, I do find I get very irritable very quickly, and then I'm shouting at the kids, or I'm shouting at the dog, or I'm shouting at my boss, or whatever. We can start to form a picture, oh, maybe there's something going on with the wood element in that person. What's really critical here is that we then need to check that. We need to come back and say, all right, so I'm going to ask a bunch of questions relating to the wood element, the set correspondences, to see if it's true, test my theory. And if it's true, in which way is it moving in his body? In other words, this is the really important thing. What is the impact of that element on the other four elements? Because very often with the popularity of five elements, I hear and I get questions from people saying, I've been told that constitutionally I have very strong metal element. I was born on such and such a day, and I've consulted the astrological charts, and it shows that that day is a metal day, and therefore constitutionally I'm metal. This is a little shortcut. Notice how it changes from I have a strong element to I'm metal. Again, labeling. And then people are under this label that they're everything to, in their bodies to do with metal and nothing else. They forget about the other four, and they're missing the point, because the really important thing is that, yes, okay, that may be an element of your makeup that's been influenced by when you were born, but you're still made up of all five elements.
And you change, yes, you grow
and
up,
it changes.
You develop, things happen in your life.
Absolutely. It's responsive to your environment, it's responsive to the things you choose to do with your life, it's responsive to what you eat, it's responsive to the seasons, it's responsive to all sorts of things. And it's in dynamic flow. It's not like a set thing that you've got this for life. It changes. So, and you can change it as well. You can recognize, yeah, I tend to, I notice that in this situation I react like that, and I can see that's related to this element. I get angry. Maybe I can think of other emotions that, or understand where that emotion's coming from, and I can change something to modify that. And this is where we get into the very interesting part of the five elements, which is each individual element has a unique and separate relationship to the other four. And this is summarized in tables. You can see this in books, and we teach this at the school, the Shiatsu school. So we say that wood is the child of fire. The child of water. Get it the right way around. It's the child of water. So if, again, you look in nature. If you have a seed sitting in the ground in the desert, for example, it can sit there for years doing nothing. For once in 10 years, it rains, and the desert turns green. Yeah, because this water germinates the seeds, and it's like a miracle. So we can see that in nature, that it makes sense that wood is the child of water. But we also say that wood is similarly or relatedly the mother of fire. So again, wood gets old, it gets dry, it gets hot, it bursts into flames. This is a natural thing. And natural forest fires are a part of the natural cycle. Which is healthy, of course, when they're set off by an accident, that's not good, but natural forest fires is part of the natural cycle. Then we can also go back to wood, and we can say that wood controls earth. So plants put down roots into the ground, and strong roots stabilizes the ground, so then the ground can't move around and slip and slide when it gets wet. So we can see that the wood controls the earth. But wood is also controlled by metal. And this one, you have to think that the earth is full of micronutrients. You know, the pH value of earth is very, very important to how plants grow or can't grow. Some like acid, some like alkali. So we can see that metals have a strong influence and control the way plants grow. So that metal controls wood. So you can see, and then so we can see each wood has a separate relationship to each of the other four. Now, if we put the emotions that relate to those elements instead of those element words, we get some very interesting ideas. It's kind of oversimplistic in a way, but I hope your listeners will really like this.
I'm really curious. Because anger is one of my emotions I need to work on. So
if we say wood is the child of water, we can say anger is the child of fear. Fear is the emotion of water. And that kind of resonates, doesn't it? It's like you're only angry because you're actually scared of what might happen.
Usually.
Yeah, very often. Not always, of course, but very often. We can also say, therefore, that wood, anger, is the mother of fire, which is joy and self-expression. And how often is it the case that when you have an argument with someone and you get angry with them, later when the anger's died down, you feel much more compassion and warmth towards that person. Yes, there's actually greater understanding and communication is freed up again. So it really makes sense. Another really obvious one, I think, for most people listening will be that wood, again, anger, controls overthinking and worry. So the anger really controls that. So it's wood controlling earth. You know, you don't know what to do and you're kind of overthinking, and you think, you know, enough. Just do it. I stopped myself. Yeah. And then finally, very interestingly, we can say that wood is controlled by metal. So anger is controlled by grief and letting go. And I think this is super important as well. Sometimes we feel that anger, all we do says, is it really worth getting angry about? Actually, no. Just let it go. It's not such a big thing.
True. And we will continue in a moment, but we need to take a break so we can come back with the next part of this episode, because it's really interesting and I want people to look forward to the next part.
Super. Thank you so much.